This is Talking to America. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. Our guest today is Richard Lucibella, publisher of SWAT Magazine. Rich, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Well, thank you, Aaron. Pleasure to be with you.
I have a couple questions for you. I suppose we ought to start with some basic things. For what does SWAT stand for?
As many of your listeners know, stands originally stood for Special Weapons and Tactics. It dates back actually to the late 60s when and is credited probably to LAPD for having created the first SWAT team. And so in the context of the magazine was started in the late 70s and used that title because it focused on special weapons and tactics for law enforcement.
You talk about law enforcement, but is your magazine just geared toward those folks in law enforcement?
No, not at all. When we purchased it in 2001, SWAT was mostly a law enforcement title. That was not the direction that we wanted to take it. But we did have the title, and the title is obviously known in the firearms community. And so we moved it from a law enforcement-only title to more of a training in tactics, which cuts across employment lines and certainly includes your average American firearms owner.
The SWAT magazine is reaching out to a lot of different people within the firearms community, I suppose we could put it that way. But what does SWAT magazine do to reach out to people beyond the firearms community? Let's call it the freedom community at large.
Well, we can't really speak of a Second Amendment. We can't really defend a right to keep and bear arms without recognizing that that right's really within the matrix of all the other rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights. And I think it's a real mistake when sometimes we focus exclusively on the Second Amendment and are not aware of the constant encroachments to search and seizure in the Fourth Amendment, to states' rights in the Tenth Amendment. So to that extent, we certainly try to alert our readers to potential dangers to all of the Bill of Rights. We have a column written by Claire Wolfe entitled Enemy at the Gate. It's a monthly column, and it is geared specifically toward the Bill of Rights, and that means all of them, including the Second.
Well, if you had to judge where we're at today in the war to preserve the right to protect one's life using a firearm, are we winning or losing?
That's a good question, and it's obviously a difficult question to answer, Aaron. I think on the state levels, we've made extraordinary gains. Concealed carry weapons laws, Castle Doctrine laws, and the like. We've just made some real gains. We're seeing laws being passed in various states which prohibit the government from confiscating weapons during emergencies, as we saw in New Orleans during Katrina. On the federal level, I mean, we did have the success of the sunset of the assault weapons ban. We didn't repeal it. It simply sunsetted. But beyond that, I don't think we're making any real strides on the federal level. And in fact, I think if anything, we're probably going backward as we see the nibbling of other rights within the Bill of Rights, as we see those shrinking on the federal level with Supreme Court decisions, with executive action like that. Once you lose ground in any of the Bill of Rights, it paves the way to lose ground in all of them. So the short answer is on the state level, I'm encouraged. On the federal level, not so much so.
Do you think that our backsliding on the federal level has anything to do with what they call the war on terror, or do you think it's an agenda for people who just want more power, that they're just control freaks?
Well, I think I need to respond to that very, very carefully, because it's very easy in a glib response for our listeners to say, oh, here's another conspiracy theorist. But and the short answer is I think it has everything to do with the war on terror, our continued erosion of freedoms. I think it has everything to do with the war on drugs. I think it has everything to do with the fact that for some reason this country has been in a continual state of, quote, war since the 1960s. That takes absolutely nothing away from our sons and daughters and brothers and sisters are in harm's way right now. I, as a personal aside, I support the war in Iraq, but that's not the issue. The issue is what's happening as a result on the domestic side. And on the domestic side, we're seeing a very dangerous jingoism amongst American citizens. We're We see too much knee-jerking of my country right or wrong. You can support this war on terror and still oppose individual elements of that war. You can have, for instance, wiretapping with FISA courts without having to support wiretapping without warrant at all. You can oppose other tools in the war on terror without having to fear that you are anti-American. As concerns the second part of your question, I think, which is, are people just hungry for power? I think that's a life cycle of a bureaucracy, of any bureaucracy. Every single bureaucracy takes on a life of its own, and its life cycle is to grow itself through the need for more budgets. We see this in a number of federal agencies. As they have need for greater budgets, they create situations that get a lot of public attention to explain that they don't have enough money to do their job, or worse yet, they don't have the legal tools to get their job done. And we see that from agencies to legislators, unfortunately, just wanting to take on more power. The problem with it is that it's a zero-sum game. People don't realize that freedom really is a zero-sum game. There's a fixed quantity of freedom when we started this country. We knew what freedom was. Look at it as a fixed bowl of freedom in the society. The only way you can grant greater freedom, greater power to an agency of the state or the federal government is by giving up some of your freedom. We see that march. It's an inevitable march in many people's minds. I'm more optimistic than that, but it's a disturbing, disturbing trend.
We talk about government agencies that want more power. You ran an article in SWAT magazine written by Claire Wolf about the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And I suppose you were wondering before you ran the article if it's going to be a good idea or not for SWAT magazine. What kind of feedback have you received?
Well, the feedback on that particular piece has been quantitatively, overwhelmingly in favor of Claire's point of view. First of all, I want to congratulate you for the work you've done in Boot the BATFE campaign.
It really isn't just the work I've done. We have a lot of different people at JPFO that have pitched in and made all these things happen.
Well, credit due to all of them. But getting back to the specifics of that piece, I gave up a long time ago on looking at Claire's column before they're published in the magazine. I honestly do not vet her columns. I look at them fresh when you look at them, when they're published. I thought it was an outstanding expose. The response was overwhelmingly positive from the standpoint that she pointed up issues that many people don't know, that the ATF has no written standards for testing firearms. Many people don't realize how little transparency there is in an ATF proceeding against an individual. And that's another problem. I mean, it dovetails on your earlier questions. At a national level, there is too little transparency in terms of interactions that we have with law enforcement. And we need to have greater transparency in order for freedom to thrive and flourish. I believe that she credited you and others with a push to have firearms in such litigation tested at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. Was that your suggestion?
That might have been the fellow she was writing about, Len Savage, who was a firearms manufacturer, and he would know more about that than I do.
To me, that makes imminent sense. They have the ability, Aberdeen Proving Grounds has the ability and knowledge, more important, to actually look at weapons and determine what is a malfunctioning weapon versus what is a purpose-built unlawful weapon. There are so many, it is so often that we see, I've seen it at the range myself, a weapon will malfunction and go full auto. Well, according to the current law, that's not the weapon's fault. It's your fault. You are in violation of some very serious laws at the moment that spring breaks, that sear breaks, or whatever. And that is just an absurdity to have to depend on this star chamber type of evaluation of the weapon that's going on with BATF versus having the examination videotaped or done by more competent sources such as in Aberdeen.
So most people were in favor of what Claire said. I was trying to get a handle on this.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. You were kind enough to give us a PDF of the article, so it is on the JPFO website. So people can listen to you, and then they can go read the article again. Let's talk a little bit more about the magazine. Do you concentrate on specific types of guns or topics?
Well, the SWAT's kind of a strange vehicle. When we first purchased the magazine, I did a down-and-dirty market study looking at what was available out there in terms of what I considered quality firearms magazines. There aren't many. But when we look at magazines like American Handgunner, which is an outstanding magazine, Soldier of Fortune, some of the others, I realized that the area that wasn't really being covered well was training and tactics. Most magazines, most firearms magazines, are what I will call hardware magazines. They have great covers with lasers coming out of and bullets coming out of barrels and great photography, and they focus on the latest and greatest new smoke pole that's just been manufactured. I wanted to take it in a different direction and concentrate a bit more on the software, which is the training and tactics, the responsibility involved in owning a firearm, how to properly employ it, how to properly employ the accessories. So to that extent, we offer a good deal more on the software side, on mindset, training, tactics, where to get the best training, what tactics are proven in given circumstances. And then we also certainly do the hardware reviews of long guns, shotguns, handguns, edged weapons, and the like. We try to throw in a balance of some humor in Lewis Auerbach's column and in Brent Wheat's column. Those tend to be a little bit lighter. Claire's column ranges from frighteningly serious to outrageously humorous in terms of her pointing up the foibles of that capital E enemy at the gate of our American freedoms. So from that standpoint, we like to say that we offer more, and I think we do. I think we're more well-rounded than most firearms books. And we certainly offer more in terms of the training and tactics at end of the spectrum.
This is Talking to America. Our host today is, actually, I'm the host today. I forgot who I am. Our guest today is Rich Lucibel. He's publisher of SWAT Magazine. Rich, getting back to the articles that you're running, something like Claire's article as an example, which is critical of a government agency. You know, when you're around people who are in law enforcement, when they're speaking after hours and they're off the record, do they ever have anything to say that is hopeful for the average American, that there's also some distrust of the federal government?
I would say yes. I would say, in fact, overwhelmingly, law enforcement officers that I talk to are well aware of the dangers of federalization. They're well aware of the fact that the tools that they want to do their job come at a cost of freedoms. And the individual officers I talk to, quite honestly, walk that tightrope very, very well. They recognize that a new law, which may make a HIBL law for mandatory identification, may make their job a bit easier, but it is at the expense of their wife and their kids' freedoms. And they're troubled by that, and they're thoughtful about it. It's when we get to the agency level, I think that we have the biggest problem, because agencies have no heart. They have no conscience. It's a non-human life form, if you will. And that's where we get into trouble, is with the agencies and sometimes with the desk jockeys.
You raised a fascinating point here. How do you suppose this non-human life form came to be in America? We're supposed to be the land of the free.
It is absolutely a factor of bureaucracy. There, whether it be a corporate bureaucracy, a military bureaucracy, any organization takes on a life form of itself and seeks to propagate and grow itself. That's just, it's the nature of every governmental agency since the history of mankind. I don't know if there's some mystical law that kind of grants it these life form powers, but I think that it's fair to compare it to a life form. There isn't a single governmental agency that we can think of that was ever reined in or dismantled without enormous human energy put into reining it in and dismantling it. When left alone, they will simply grow and grow and grow. And part of that, quite honestly, is our fault. A large part of that is our fault as citizens and voters, because we continue to look to have to be protected. We continue to look to our pet issues, and we have a tendency to want everybody to comply with our standards of behavior on our pet issues. But then we don't realize when we do that, that also grants other special interest groups the right to demand that we comply with standards of behavior on their issues, whether it be what you may say in public, whether or not you may object to a police action without recrimination, whether or not you can own a firearm or carry a firearm. And so everybody has got their hand in the pot to try to get everybody else to kind of conform to their way of life. And that's what grants these bureaucracies, I believe, that's what grants these bureaucracies their life force.
I've often thought, Rich, that what we have to do is bring back America to America. And by that I mean bring back a Bill of Rights culture, so that every single existing piece of legislation or proposed legislation that violates the Bill of Rights is null and void. And I think that would do away with a lot of agencies.
You're preaching to the choir on that one. I happen to be, I'm a libertarian with a small L. I think that getting back to a simpler set of laws whereby Americans know when they are engaging in an illegal activity. Today, you don't even know whether or not the activity that you're involved in may violate some law. And I'm sure we all violate laws regularly and unknowingly. When you look at the alphabet soup of agencies that have regulations over our daily activity, there's virtually no activity that we engage in that isn't somehow regulated. But getting back to the nub of your point, a test, a Bill of Rights test, for every single law that is passed in this country is absolutely the way to go. Unfortunately, if we instituted such a test and we did it retroactively, we would probably cut the federal code down by about 92-95%, because many of the laws on the books and much of the bureaucracy on the books is a violation or an encroachment of certain of the Bill of Rights. And I know that sounds to a lot, that's going to sound like an extremist position. And I guess maybe it is an extremist position if loving freedom and really cherishing the American ideal and the American way of life, if that's considered extremist, I guess I fall into that category. I know you do.
No doubt about that. Well, let's get back to the magazine for a moment. You know, over the years, people have watched a lot of gun-oriented magazines offer test reviews. And, gee whiz, that gun always is fantastic in the magazine. I'm wondering what kind of pressure you get from advertisers to print glowing reviews.
Well, believe it or not, very little, Aaron. At this point, very little. When I purchased SWAT magazine in 2001, I flew out to Arizona and met with the editor, Denny Hansen, got a sense for who he was. And I said, I'll tell you what, we're going to do this as a social experiment. Let's see if we can have a gun magazine out there that really tells it like it is, doesn't kiss up to advertisers, and let's see if advertisers and subscribers will buy it. And advertising is naturally a large part of our ability to continue our revenues. Well, we took on that attitude and learned some lessons about it. We lost one or two major advertisers, and because we absolutely panned their weapons. I can think of one shotgun in particular that was about to be used in Afghanistan. And we reviewed it, and the review did not come out well. And we printed that, and we lost that advertiser. They still won't speak to me. And to an extent, they're probably right. It's one thing to tell it like it is. I guess I didn't need to feature them prominently on the cover in an article that was most unflattering. And so I learned that lesson. Since then, we've really gained a reputation. We're very, very seldom asked, hey, listen, can we see a copy of the review before it's printed? We always refuse, but it very seldom comes up. I can speak of at least three manufacturers that we approached and said, listen, we've got a review of your handgun or your rifle. And the review is an honest review, but we have a couple major problems with it, and we're going to print it, But the reason we're approaching you is that we've got a great shot for the cover, and we'll give you the choice. If you don't want it on the cover, we won't put it there. In all three cases, those potential advertisers or advertisers, they were all gun manufacturers, said, well, we know how you do things. We know you're going to be honest about it. Put it on the cover. We'll take our chances. And so the industry doesn't have to be quite as whorish as many think that it is. If you go through, in SWAT's case, if you go through any issue and you look at who we're covering in editorial and try to compare that to the list of advertisers, you're going to find a real disconnect there, because it is disconnected. We very much separate advertising from editorial, let the chips fall where they may. And you'll seldom see latest, greatest, you have to have this firearm review in SWAT magazine.
Couple of final questions for you. You folks have a website?
www.swatmag.com.
And what can people expect to find on that site?
Well, the site will show our current issue, complete table of contents, introductory description for each of the features in that issue, and in all back issues. You can search the website for a term you may be looking for in order to see whether or not we covered a certain firearm in past. You can also subscribe. Naturally, we have a shopping area where you can buy back issues in PDF or printed form, and you can renew your subscription to the magazine. And we also offer some freebies. We have, for every issue that we've published since July 01, you can download in PDF format a free sample of that issue called SWAT Snapshots, which is, maybe 8 or 10 pages, 12, 15 pages of editorial from that issue, full-text articles, trying to give you a sample of what we're about in each issue.
Where does one find SWAT Magazine if they don't have a subscription?
If you don't have a subscription, we have good coverage in Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. We are now in 7-Elevens, the majority of the 7-Elevens nationwide. We can be a little bit hard to find. It's the nature of regrowing a title that was pretty much dormant 5 years ago. Regrowing a title into new outlets is a painstaking and slow process. We've done very well at it. We're in four times the number of outlets we were just 2 years ago, and continue to grow. But generally, those are the best places: your bookstores, your newsstands, 7-Eleven.
If someone wants to subscribe, do you have a number they can call?
800-673-4595. Subscriptions kind of falls where it's gonna fall, and that is just has grown real, real well. We've been, I'm very grateful for the response gun owners have given the magazine. We've done well.
Okay, what is the website again?
That is www.swatmag.com.
Okay, just to show you're a nice guy, are there any other magazines that you would recommend people read?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. American Handgunner, I already mentioned. I think that they're fabulous. I think that the artwork, Ishii Nagata's artwork in it alone, is worth the price of admission. But more than that, Huntington's ability to walk the fine line that we walk also between honest review and the need to pay the bills is great. Colonel Bob Brown, Soldier of Fortune, remains just an icon in print magazines in this area. Bob and I are close friends. He's been very much a mentor to me in the first couple of years since I took over the book. I think that's a phenomenal book.
Well, Rich, I want to thank you for being with us today. This has been Talking to America. Our guest today has been Richard Lucibella, publisher of SWAT Magazine. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman, and I'd like to remind you, if you don't defend your rights, don't complain when you lose them.
Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of JPFO.org or its members. Talkin' to America is a production of JPFO.org.